Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, everyone. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and we at Shattered Lives are so very excited to welcome you to this unique show, taking you beyond the details of the crime and the perpetrator, and getting to the heart of what crime victim families experience and what they need in the aftermath of the crime. Prior to each show, please go to www.donnagore.com or imaginepublicity.com to read the background of the case of the organization featured the week before our show is aired. And please don't forget, if you can't listen in live from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, you can always listen at any time, anywhere, even in your jammies from our archival feature. It's posted about 24 hours or so with a summary blog, and the podcast is embedded, and please do look for our graphic. It's the big red heart with the cracks. So with that, I say good evening, everyone. It's very nice to be back here on the radio. Want to let you know that I had a very warm and very rewarding holiday in the Carolinas, as I hope everyone else had a very good holiday. And it's increasingly becoming my favorite place to be, especially in this winter. And with 2013 coming to be, that votes for perhaps some new goals and some changes with regard to the type of things I've been doing. I mean, we're still going to continue this radio show and my blogs, but you might see a few different things, some additions. Maybe I'll be venturing into the world of some presentations or some on-the-road shows again. I'd like to do a few of those this year. But you'll just have to come along for the ride with me, and we'll see what develops. So that's part of life in the uniqueness, the diversity of how things evolve here. But some things don't change. I still have my mainstay, the person who helps me steer this ship, my co-host, the wonderful and talented Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. Delilah, thanks for being here, and thanks for putting up with me. I know it's not easy all the time, but somebody's got to do it. Welcome.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, Donna. Somebody has to do it. Well, I'm very, very excited about this show today because I like shows that impart a lot of good information for the public. You know, and a lot of issues I come to the table with ignorance about any issue you throw at me. So I kind of like to think that I'm the average Joe out there who really isn't impacted in my life with specific things, whether it's related to crime or missing persons and disabilities. It hasn't been the first thing in my life that I've had to deal with. So the guests that we bring on educate me so well and mm-hmm. give me a different outlook on things. So I'm very, very interested in this show. I can't wait to get started.
Yeah, well, I hope that I taught you a few things about disability in 2.5 years. So, but Melissa has a wealth of information, too. Without further ado, just wanted to give you a little bit of background. In the disability community in Connecticut, Melissa Marshall needs no introduction. She has a wealth of knowledge. Her degree of advocacy knows no bounds. She's very well known and respected. She graduated from Hampshire College. She's been a lifelong disability rights advocate. She obtained her law degree from University of Connecticut Law School. She's been the executive director of a number of nonprofits, such as the Director of Protection and Advocacy for Mentally Ill Persons program. Also, the executive director for Disabilities Network of Eastern Connecticut. She's written a particular book called Getting It, Persuading Organizations and Individuals to Be Comfortable with People with Disabilities. a very tall order, I might say. She's been executive director for another agency called Advocacy Unlimited. And most recently, well, within the recent past, the Connecticut Business Leadership Network, which supports businesses in recruiting, hiring, and retaining employees with disabilities, which is such an important mission. And lastly, the thing that she's working on most currently, and which we will probably get into the second half of the hour, is that she works as a consultant with the governor's Governor Mulloy's Prevention Partnership, where she's working on an initiative to reduce bullying and harassment of students with disabilities. So, Melissa, I said welcome so much to Shattered Life. It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the great introduction, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. It's our pleasure. And, you know, just because I have a disability as well doesn't mean I know everything. So I think every time I speak with you, I learn something, and that's the beauty of it. There's a myriad of things that we could talk about, and I know that in the promo that Delilah did, often have authors, she put in information about the book that you did write. And just maybe to give people a little bit of background or a primer, you know, when you talk about getting it and understanding about disabilities, I mean, we could talk the whole hour on that topic alone, but can you tell us a little bit about the involvement of your book, and what is it that the general public would need to do to maybe get it to be comfortable, just kind of as a primer?
That could take up like 6 hours right there, but to be brief, and I will try to be disciplined and I will try to be brief about this. The genesis of getting it, the true story about why I wrote Getting It, is I was on maternity leave and I was bored, and Martha Stewart does not live in my house. I don't particularly cook or clean or do any of those domestic things, some because of my disability, some because of my personality, so I don't do those things. So I was home with an infant who had childcare part of the time, and I decided I wanted to do the thing that was almost the most like training that I could, that I could have almost as much fun as I do doing disability awareness training, legal training. So the thing that was almost as much fun as doing disability awareness training was writing about it. And that's why I decided to write Getting It. And what Getting It is, it's a story of me developing awareness training. It's got little blurbs of the awareness training in it, and what worked, what didn't work, how I developed it, why I developed it, and shows me doing the training at a variety of audiences. At first, I piloted for nonprofits. It was funded by the Boston Globe Foundation. Thank you, Boston Globe and Boston, Massachusetts. So I worked in nonprofit organizations. Then I did it in schools. I was in Weaver High School in Hartford, Connecticut for 3 years doing disability awareness and including kids with significant disabilities in mainstream classes. So I did that. And then I went on to do awareness training in corporations. And so it kind of catalogs all of those things, plus it has some funny road stories, traveling as a person with a disability and the things we all have to put up with that are kind of amusing. But anyway, so I did that and just got an opportunity to document things, and I found that really valuable. And in documenting it, I got to share awareness about disability issues.
Uh-huh. Well, that, you know, I'm sure it certainly fulfilled your need and keeping you busy. And then, again, it also is documented forever for all of us to take advantage of that knowledge that you have, and it's still available, my understanding, on Amazon and whatnot.
Yes, it is, on Amazon. And the moral of the story is that whether I presented to corporations, high school students, or nonprofits, the audiences were all the same, and there were always some people who got it right away and some people who didn't. And there's characters that come to the trainings, and some of the characters were immature. That didn't mean they're high school students. That meant they could be CEOs of companies, and some of the audience members of the audiences really understood, and they could be high school students, and we saw consistency throughout in doing the training as to who understood what people asked for questions. They might use different words, but they all said the same thing, and they all asked the same questions.
Well, that's interesting. Can you tell us maybe a little bit about, for the benefit of our audience, how has your personal experience with disability influenced your many accomplishments? And then maybe you can address what are a couple of the main things about, they get it, or maybe you have a story
kind of,
or two about getting it.
Kind of why do I do this? I was born with mild cerebral palsy, And for me, what that means is I was a toe walker. I walked on my toes, and they had to lengthen my heel cords. I had surgery as a kid, and I went through several months where I didn't walk, and they weren't quite sure why, and they had to do surgery. And so when it came time for me to go to high school, I couldn't go to my public high school because my public high school had three or four floors in three buildings. It was the kind of thing where they had home ec in one building and science in another building and things that they just couldn't move around. So my mother and I fought for 2 years for me to get a free and appropriate public education, which was then becoming the law at that point nationally. It was just about becoming the law then, I'm dating myself now. So I learned very quickly that the law wasn't necessarily worth the paper it was written on unless you were able to advocate for yourself or have someone advocate with you. And I decided when I was in college that that's what I wanted to do professionally. And I was able at Hampshire College to major in disability studies, which is a major kind of parallel to like a gender studies major or an African American studies major or a Native American studies major, where I examine cultural, political, and legal ramifications of having a disability in our society. So I learned everything from sign language, linguistics, to how to do an architectural access survey, to those kinds of things. And that was like really before disability studies was actually a field. Again, I date myself. So that's why I do what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I've done some of what I've done.
Well, yeah, and I think with it being so specialized, but yet you're able to do a number of different things within the realm of disability that just makes you all the more, you know, knowledgeable, marketable, interesting, et cetera. And, Delilah, do you have any particular questions in the beginning here that come to mind that maybe you want to offer as a layperson, as you say? I don't like when you say you come from ignorance, because you certainly don't, but you lend a different perspective. And
I haven't had personal experience with some of the issues we bring up. And so it's always a great learning tool here for me. And, you know, I can remember, and I can date myself, too. I went to public schools. I don't remember any other children with disabilities within my classes. And I guess, you know, back then, where did they go?
Where we went is there's a school that was radical for its time, and it was then called the Massachusetts Hospital School for Crippled Children. I kid you not. And it was started by it was started by a woman named Dr. Margaret Brayton, and she was revolutionary in that she had a PhD, you know, before women typically had PhDs, and she decided that kids with disabilities deserve to be educated. Now, we now see that as segregated education, that's, you know, separate's never equal, and we all know that. That's really not okay, but at that time, people did that. So children would have to go to institutions. Kids with physical disabilities were in institutions. Kids with psychiatric disabilities were institutions. Certainly kids with cognitive disabilities, unfortunately, were in institutions. Others of us were sitting at home. I got tutored for 2 hours a week, you know, for a very short period of time, and that's what they considered schooling. And I remember getting Algebra 1 in a period of 2 weeks, got a B+ in the final, did really well, and 2 weeks later you couldn't tell me if you tested me if I'd ever taken it. You know, just things just didn't stick. So we got shortchanged. We got segregated education if we got any education at all. And then I remember when I was in school, at a certain point, an organization saying to me, well, we don't think you can handle, maybe you can handle community college. And I'm saying, but I want to get a four-year degree, and I want to go to law school. You know, and I told them the colleges I was applying to. So we were discouraged from having education. And I'd always been a straight-A student, so it wasn't based on anything. It was just based on the fact that they didn't want to deal with me. So
I have very similar stories of discrimination going to colleges, too, Melissa.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
It sounds so familiar.
Exactly. And so we were there in Delilah. We existed. Some of us were locked in institutions. Some of us were in back bedrooms. Some of us were sitting home trying to get an education, and the lucky ones got to go to school, but that wasn't the vast majority of us.
Right, and I was relegated from first to third grade to quote-unquote handicap class, where they kind of lumped us all in one class.
Right.
And I was in the minority where I was, you know, considered college-bound, but ultimately stayed back 1 year because I had so many orthopedic surgeries for my cerebral palsy, and I was making the transition into regular public school, that was, you know, a milestone, and they wanted to keep me back 1 year. But it's true, they kind of lumped us all together. And but, you know, we broke through, and things have changed and definitely come full circle. But again, there's so much more that does need to be done. And there's still, I know we can get into in a little bit perhaps, you know, there's something like 70% of people with disabilities, or even well-educated people like us, are still unemployed, which is unconscionable. But one of your many accomplishments in your areas of expertise is being a consultant for the American with Disabilities Act. And although it's been around since 1990, I know that there's been some changes, and there was a treaty just tried to be voted on and enacted. Can you touch on those topics a bit?
Absolutely. And again, if you let me, I literally talk to you for 5 days about the ADA and have, so you're all being spared that today. So I will make things brief and know that I'm leaving out lots and lots of detail. The ADA was signed by George Herbert Walker Bush on July 26, 1990. We're coming up on our 23rd anniversary. I can't even believe that. So that's really, really exciting. And I remember after they signed the ADA, people said, and we worked really hard, their coalition of 180 disability rights groups that worked to pass the ADA. And we all got along, and we all coalesced, which was kind of a minor miracle in and of itself. And the ADA is radical, incredibly progressive disability rights legislation. It's the most progressive piece of disability rights legislation that's ever been enacted in the world. And I remember writing that one time, and someone was reviewing what I said, and she said, "That's subjective, right?" I said, "No, that's factual. It's the most progressive piece of disability rights legislation ever to have been enacted in the world." That's not to say that the United States has the most progressive disability policies, but we have the most progressive piece of legislation. And we said to each other, once the bill was signed, now the work begins. We had to teach people about the ADA, and what happened was, is I spent a good 10, 15 years doing primarily education in the Americans with Disabilities Act through school districts and companies and businesses and nonprofits, like I said. And that involved everything from getting down on my hands and knees, which I could back then, to do architectural access surveys, to doing training, to writing about the issues. So that's where the ADA was. And what happened was, is I have a graphic where I have a dog jumping through hoops. And first hoop is the dog jumps through the hoop where the dog has to prove that it has a disability. Now, people of color typically and women typically don't have to prove their gender or their race. But people with disabilities, we knew we'd always have to prove that we had a disability. So I show the dog jumping through that hoop. Then the dog has to jump through the hoop proving that the dog has been discriminated against. So there's two hoops. You have to prove definition, then discrimination. And what I showed in the slides that I have is the dog's jumping through the hoops at first, and then the hoop proving definition gets higher and higher, and that dog has to jump through a really high hoop to prove that the dog has been discriminated against, because it got really, really hard for a long time for people with disabilities to prove that they've been discriminated against. And I was against touching the Americans with Disabilities Act because we'd worked so hard to get it, but the courts eroded and eroded and eroded the definition. And I remember at one point, and I don't remember the exact facts of the case, so forgive me, but a young man who finished high school with a certificate of completion, had always been in special ed classes, was someone who had a job coach, and his IQ was around the borderline. I forget exactly what it was, but it was found that he hadn't shown that he had a disability because the judge said he could drive a car, therefore he wasn't disabled. And at that point,
that was his narrow definition, that because he could drive a car, he wasn't disabled?
He didn't have a disability, so they never got to find out if that company was discriminated against him. For all I know, the company wasn't illegally discriminated against him, but we never got to find out the issue. So those of us who've been really not wanting to mess with the ADA at that point decided we needed to do something about it, and the ADA Amendments Act was passed. And to make a long story short, it was passed a couple of years ago, what it says, it doesn't broaden the definition of disability, but it clarifies it. So you have this law where no word in the law, no word is changed in the statute, but words are changed in the regulation interpreting it. So it makes the ADA to be like what we thought it was. And it talks about what, you know, one of the questions is, you're considered disabled if you're substantially limited in major life activity. And one of the major life activities, we used to talk about walking and talking and seeing and breathing and things like that. Now, a major life activity is things like normal cell reproduction. You know, so we automatically include people with cancer and people with disabilities like that. And what Congress said when it passed the ADA Amendments Act is, we didn't intend to figure out how many wheelchairs could dance in the head of a pin. We didn't intend to have these long, protracted discussions about what does and does not constitute a disability. We want to protect people with disabilities from discrimination. And that's what the ADA Amendments Act does. And the interesting thing is, when I was with Connecticut Business Leadership Network, I was training lots and lots of corporations. And what I found that's really interesting is, one, corporations want to hire people with disabilities, and that's real. We have a high unemployment rate, and we're going to get to that yet. But two, a lot of the organizations, the large corporations, I tell them what they had to do. It's called reasonable accommodation under the law. They're like, we don't care. We just want to make the workplace accessible so we can get the most productivity out of all our employees. And that was a really encouraging thing for me to see. So we have the ADA Amendments Act, which is really exciting, kind of has revitalized the ADA. And I think now the onus is on people with disabilities still to learn about the ADA, learn about what their rights are, also learn what their rights are not. Some people see the ADA as a panacea. People used to always say to me, oh, you work for the ADA. No, the ADA is a law. Oh, you get money from the – how do I get benefits from the ADA? The ADA is a civil rights law. It's not an affirmative action statute. We can debate affirmative action and one way or the other, but it's kind of irrelevant under the ADA because the ADA is not an affirmative action statute. The intention of the ADA is to create a level playing field where people with disabilities are treated equally. We don't get special treatment. We get equal treatment. Does that make sense?
But isn't it true, Melissa, that in the expansion or the interpretation of the regulations, how did people who are drug addicted get to be considered under the ADA?
People who are addicted to drugs, people who illegally use drugs, doesn't matter if it's a drug that's a prescription drug that they're using illegally or drug they buy in the street, are not protected under the ADA. Except, lots of times I say it depends and except.
Okay.
Except when someone has a history of being addicted, then they're protected because of their history. So you're protected if you're substantially limited in one or more major life activities, have a record of having a disability, or regarded as having a disability. So if I'm someone who's been clean, let's make it an easy case, for 5 years, and they don't hire me for a job because they find this out, or they fire me because they find this out, I'm protected as someone with a disability under the ADA. If I'm someone who's still using, I'm not protected. Where it gets gray is, at what point do you have a history? Is that an hour? Probably not. Is that 3 days? Probably not. Is it 3 months? Then we're getting into maybe. It's not what we call a bright
line
test.
That's really interesting. That is very interesting, and I had no idea that it was covered under ADA.
Mm-hmm. If you have a history, you can't be using now, illegally.
Right. No. I understand that. However, the other side of the argument could be, and I know you probably have a good answer for this, is drug addiction, is it something that is inherent, or is it something that is a disability by choice?
I'm not an addiction specialist, but what people would say to you is that it's a genetically induced disease.
Mm-hmm.
Addiction is a disease. You know, alcoholism, drug addiction are diseases.
Just
like cancer.
Yeah.
Just like cancer, just like schizophrenia, just like cerebral palsy. Well, just like muscular dystrophy, cerebral palsy is a brain injury, but just like any other disability, it's something that happens to you. And it's cloudier with addiction because people see elements of choice to it, but it's still a genetically based disease. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
That gives you my opinion anyway.
Well, it's really good food for thought in terms of the, but like you said, the operative term there is history and defining that. So, you know, because that kind of stuck with me. I said, oh, you know, why is that included? So I'm glad you clarified that. And can you get into a bit about the United Nations convention and the treaty that was just addressed by Congress and how that differs from the ADA and what happened, because to me it's just so maddening that this was not passed. Can you tell our audience about it?
It's so frustrating. In December, a UN resolution was before Congress, and it would basically what it says is that people with disabilities will have protections parallel to the United States, you know, and other countries are supporting the human rights of people with disabilities. And what happened was, and so it wasn't something that was going to change law in this country. It really wasn't going to change law in other countries. It kind of like it was a treaty, you know, a UN treaty with the clout, all the clout that carries and doesn't carry. And it went before Congress, and Senator Bob Dole, who is very active around the Americans with Disabilities Act and is a Republican and has a disability himself, came before the Senate using a wheelchair now, which is what he uses for mobility, and asked Congress in a really powerful and poignant way to pass this treaty, and they rejected it. And it says to me how much Congress in this country values people with disabilities. 29 other countries, including China, have signed this treaty. So it's safe to say China's record, China's commitment around human rights in that instance is more progressive than the United States. And I think that's
more, that's just incredible. When I read a few articles online about it, and some of the excuses, they were so half-baked in terms of what some of our people from Congress, and, you know, John Kerry was very supportive of it, but some of the other, it just did not make sense. So is this going to be able to come up again and be voted on again?
I think it certainly will, and people are preoccupied with the then impending fiscal cliff and all of that, but I think it's just really frustrating. People were saying things that would interfere with people's ability to homeschool, which just didn't make any sense. And there's just a bunch of other arguments that just did not make sense. So if you hear some arguments about it that don't seem to make intuitive sense to you, it's because that they don't. And it was just – and one of the things we need to work on in this country, or generally in the disability rights movement, is we have a civil rights movement of people with disabilities. We've passed these major laws. We've made these major strides. And in some circles, we're still not – in many circles, I should say, we're still not seen as a legitimate civil rights group. We're not seen – we're legally a protected class, but we're not viewed that way by people in similar positions that are members of other protected classes. And I think that's something that, you know, saddens me. It's a one step forward, two steps backward.
And why do you think that is? I agree with you. I'm in that faction as well as in the GBLT community, as well as, you know, the community with crime victims. So I have my foot in many of these my minority affiliations.
I don't know is the answer to the question. It's something
that's
I spent a lot of time thinking about. I think one of the things is people with disabilities get marginalized, and people from both the right and the left kind of buy into that, and they see us as a charity or the people that need to be protected rather than – or they see how people with disabilities are treated as – them not being nice to us rather than what I would call ableism, which is oppression based on physical, mental, or cognitive or other kind of ability. And I think people don't take this seriously as other kinds of oppression.
And then you get into the issues. I see that in my own job with state government, and get into the whole entitlement issue and, this poor group, and we have to protect them no matter what. And they don't really get to see what the real world is like.
Well, what
happens, too,
and some of this is for our next half hour, is we alternate between being these people that should be pitied if we have a certain kind of disability, maybe a physical disability or maybe a sensory disability, like we're blind or deaf, and wouldn't you hate to be that person, to being someone who's feared and villainized like people with psychiatric disabilities, which is really interesting. So we kind of play both roles. We're to be pitied or to be feared, but we're not seen as much as we should. And this is changing more and more as people that are oppressed. Because I notice a lot of times people are talking about the coalition that helped get President Obama elected. And people with disabilities were very much part of that coalition and very active in it. There's been disability policy committees, and we've been really on top of that. And yet when I hear the left talking, and of which I'm a member, I'm a proud person from the left, but when I hear the left talking about it, they tend not to talk about people with disabilities being included in that coalition, and I don't quite get why yet. So we keep working on it.
Because we're not seen. We might be heard occasionally, but they don't like to see us with our hardware or whatever.
I don't know. I don't know. There's a lot of complicated dynamics behind it. And we're the only protected class that anyone can join at any moment with or without their consent. And I think that makes us different. That makes, you know, and Delilah, you're saying you don't have any disability experience. And if you live a long, healthy life, which we all hope that you will, there's an 83% chance at least that you will have some disability experience. So it's kind of everybody. It's not just, you know, discrete groups.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Going back to the issue of attitude, so to speak, do you feel like the internet has been helpful or harmful for people with disabilities? And the reason that I ask that is, and I know Donna and I have had this discussion before, when we first met online and over the phone, I had no idea she had a disability. I didn't know until she told me.
Right.
So there was that, you know, that friendship.
And boy, was she surprised. No.
camaraderie and so forth and understanding between us that was built over time professionally that, why would I care? You know what I'm saying?
That's a really interesting question, and I'm probably a bad person to ask that question. I'm kind of a technophobe. The answer that I know is the truth is that the internet has been better for people with disabilities. It makes it easier for some people who have a hard time to work from home. It makes a number of things easier. I'm not real good technologically. I'm not real comfortable technologically. Has it made my life better? A grudging yes is the answer to that question, but I go kicking and screaming. So, and I think... And I think the interesting thing around disabilities, you met Donna without her having to disclose. If you met me when I'm not using my scooter, which is less and less, I'm using my scooter more and more, you'd never know that I had a disability. So I used to have the privilege of traveling in both worlds so that I may choose to tell you I had a disability. I may not choose to tell you I have a disability. And my kind of interesting perspective is I get to see how people treat me when I'm using my wheelchair versus how they treat me when I'm not using my wheelchair. And when I've been using my wheelchair for a long time, I always forget every single time. It's really funny that you think I'd learn this, but it's very different. It's a different kind of experience. And so there's I always worry. I said that people with disabilities can work more from home. And again, we'll talk more about this in the next half hour. I think we need to be real careful not to be relegated to working from home behind our computers. And I think that's something we need to, you know, some people choose to do that. Some people like doing this. Some people don't doing that. And I think if we're working from home because that's a choice and it's what we're most comfortable with, that's fine. But I want to be really careful that we don't get relegated to that, you can just work from your house.
Because, again, it's isolating you. I mean, I would prefer because I'm much more of a people person.
Right.
And we talked about this in ENFJ, and you're an ENFP. So.
I am an ENFP and proud of it.
So
for those of you that don't know, that's Myers-Briggs personality test.
So we need that social connection. We need that social connection to other people. We don't need to be sitting behind the computer in our lonely house with an echo. You know, I need to be out there in the world. But anyway, that's me.
Right.
So I think that's very interesting. Can you speak a little bit, because we're just passing over to the second half hour, with regard to, I know, in working for an agency for the blind for many years, 13 years now, going on 13 years, the number has always been projected that despite all of the wonderful things that our agency does and the technology provided and everything, unemployment is still about 70% overall for people who are legally blind. Or visually impaired, and other disabilities as well. And I know that you had some very good points with regard to, I think we all need to hear this, including Delilah, because we need to know about building a case for hiring, and it's not about the stereotypes that we usually talk about. So if you could address that for a couple of minutes, I think that would be very valuable, Melissa.
Sure. We talk about the business case for hiring people with disabilities, and there's a study done by UMass Amherst, and this is all on the Office of Disability Employment website. It's called ODEP, so you can look under business case for hiring people with disabilities. And something like 80% of people prefer doing businesses that hire people with disabilities. So if you get someone on a cash register with a disability, people like that and will spend their money with you. People with disabilities individually represent $120 billion of disposable income annually. That's higher than the coveted teen market. If you consider our family members, it's $1 trillion annually. So we represent a huge untapped market and a huge amount of potential business. So businesses need to show that they're disability positive. I like to say disability friendly because that kind of implies it's an option. They're disability positive, and that's really important. So
mm-hmm.
it really can increase their business by hiring people with disabilities.
And is this study being used when you go to small businesses or corporations and saying, look, this is proof positive?
Absolutely,
or,
positively.
You know,
absolutely, positively. And businesses are starting to learn that. The large businesses know it. The small businesses are just beginning to learn it. And it's tricky because our unemployment rate, as you said, and it's no different for any of the disability community than it is for the blind community, is about 70%. It has not changed
right.
since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And
right.
and one of the questions people always ask me is why? And my answer is I don't know. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I'm working on another book where I'm going to address that a lot, but I don't know, because if 30 years ago you told me we were going to have the most progressive disability rights law ever been enacted anywhere in the world, that work disincentives would have been largely eroded, which by work disincentives I mean that you'll lose your health insurance benefits if you get a Social Security. Those disincentives are largely gone, and the businesses
mm-hmm.
were going to understand that why it was good to hire people with disabilities and would actively be seeking to do that. I'd have been beside myself and thrilled and happy and excited, and I would have assumed that our unemployment rate would have been competitive with at least other protected classes, and it's not. It's so much
mm-hmm.
more. And
yeah.
it's complicated, and part of it is I look at things like education. I think right now one of the things that I saw was with CTBLN was often I had more companies wanting to hire qualified people with disabilities than I had people with disabilities who were prepared to enter the workplace.
To fill them, you mean? Is that what you mean?
To fill the supply-demand
kind of thing?
What's that?
The supply-demand?
Yes. Yes, the supply-demand is there weren't enough people with disabilities. And I have to ask myself, why, what that reason is. And I think of things like education. I think we're still, education for people with disabilities has obviously come a long way, but largely we're segregated. I've heard it referred to as the tyranny of low expectations, where people rise or fall to the level of what you expect from them if you don't have high expectations of them, and
yeah.
that people aren't going to have the motivation to succeed, aren't going to have the motivation to go on to higher education. And
mm-hmm.
it's a really tricky dynamic because I think, and sometimes it could look like stereotyping people. Or I knew what I was fighting against when I was in high school. They said, we don't want you here. We think you're a fire hazard because you use crutches. No, I think that's morally reprehensible.
A fire hazard.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
but I knew what I was fighting against. Now the discrimination looks like a teacher saying to a kid, you can do anything you want in the world, when they're lying and they don't think it's true. So, or praising a child, I talk about this in my book, for being able to push or, you know, be able to press a button on her joystick and navigate her way around to school when that's a really
yeah.
simple task. And
right.
how good does that make her feel about, or bad does that make her feel about herself, if that's the thing about her to be celebrated. So I think there's been discrimination in education, a certain amount of low expectations, a certain amount of not demanding from people with disabilities what you demand from other people.
Right.
And I think there's also a dynamic, what I tell myself when I want to feel better, and I think this is true, is the disability rights movement compared to the civil rights movement, compared to the women's rights movement, is really, really young. It's really still in its embryonic stages. So
mm-hmm.
I think we need to pay attention to that, going, we've only been doing this for a little while. And
well,
so
that's true. Mm-hmm.
So we need to think about that. So I think there's hope, but I think we've still got a long, long way to go.
Yeah, well, we say that about so many of the other populations that we work with, too, and it's just, you know, kind of one day at a time, and that is so true. Fascinating. Listen, can we segue a little bit into some other areas here?
Of course.
Two areas. I'd like to hear more about what you're doing with the Governor's Prevention Council with respect to how do we assist with regard to people with disabilities in school settings that get bullied and harassed? And I know Robin McKeown does a lot of stuff with this with regard to GBLT issues. We've had her on long time ago, and I just listened to the show. It was great. And also the other, you know, you've had specific training and imparted information with regard to mental illness. And knowing what we've gone through in the past couple of weeks in Sandy Hook, that's something I want to address too. So I give you the floor on either of those topics, Melissa.
Okay. Like I said, I spend the rest of our time and plus. Let me start with bullying for now, okay? And then
okay.
I'll get to Sandy Hook and psychiatric disability. I have had an affiliation since, I want to say, June with the Governor's Prevention Partnership. And the Governor's Prevention Partnership, for those people that don't know, is a Connecticut organization. It's a private nonprofit organization where the acting governor is the ex officio chair. So it's not just from Governor Malloy. It's whoever happens to be governor. He's been a very active member, and we appreciate his commitment to the partnership. And we started as a prevention organization. We have doing anti-drug work, and right now we're doing a mentoring initiative. We're doing an anti-underage drinking initiative, and my division is doing, for which I'm a consultant, I'm not an employee, my division is doing a safe schools, the Safe Schools Project, and we work on bullying issues in the schools. And the partnership brought me in because they were addressing, they work with Two Colors and Robin McCallan a lot on LGBT issues and bullying and, you know, and harassment based on race and, you know, of students. And they brought me in to address the issue of students with disabilities. And I was really excited to be there because I've just learned so much and discovered so much. One thing that's really exciting and applicable to people across the country is that we have an anti-bullying statute in Connecticut, which is good. But when you consider the rights of a child with a disability, they have additional rights that typical kids do not have. For instance, it was said by Judy Heumann, who was kind of the mother of the independent living movement and the disability rights movement. She was assistant secretary of OSTRS, the Office of Special Education. I think I'm getting that right. And as assistant secretary, she wrote a Dear Colleague letter saying, by the way, if you're allowing bullying to happen in your school, you're not providing children with disability. You may not be providing children with disabilities the required free and appropriate public education. They call it FAPE. It's required under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And so Judy wrote this in 2000. I've been doing disability work full-time since I was pretty much 17 years old, and I did not know about this. And I called a friend who's also, you know, who's an expert in disability issues and ADA. I said, you know, Judy Heumann said this. She said, well, she said lots of things. I'm like, no, as assistant secretary in a Dear Colleague letter in 2000. She went, what? So this kind of silos where the disability community wasn't aware what's been said about bullying, and the anti-bullying community isn't aware of the disability issue. So I got to kind of go back and forth and bridge these things. So it's really exciting. So if you're a parent of a child with a disability, there's some additional rights that your child has under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there's additional legal protections that just might be available to you, which is really exciting. And
that's
with
good.
The additional protections, there's children with disabilities have an individualized education plan. And with that education plan, individualized education plan is an extra tool where you can address bullying and harassment through the individualized education plan. Whether the child is someone who is targeted for bullying or a child that initiates bullying, because children with disabilities sometimes initiate bullying, sometimes to establish their point of the pecking order in the hierarchy, sometimes because they might have social skills where they're trying to mimic the popular kids where they don't quite get it, and so they're mimicking that depending on what their disability is. So it's all kinds of great stuff here that I've done with Governor's Prevention Partnership. So it's really exciting.
Well, that sounds very innovative and good. So you're continuing to be on that council and work on those issues.
I'm a consultant for the organization for right now. With the fiscal cliff, we're looking at funding issues. Donna said it was all right to say I'm looking for a job, so I am. I'm looking for other positions, and I love doing what I'm doing with the Governor's Prevention Partnership as a consultant. They're doing wonderful things on all kinds of levels for all kinds of people, all kinds of kids.
That is good, but we still have to find things to pay the bills. Right?
Exactly. The other thing I want to say is we all know bullying is severe, and bullying impacts so many kids, and it impacts lots and lots of kids with disabilities. Now, when I say that to people, they'll say, what are the statistics? And I come up with the statistics, and it's a really high rate. Whenever I say to an adult who's born with a disability, were you bullied? The answer is yes, 100% of the time. That's my anecdotal study. There have been studies showing children on the autism spectrum to be bullied at a rate of 100% sometimes. And that might be an outlier, but others say 70%. So there's the bullying of people with disabilities is astronomically high, and it's something that we need to really address and seriously address. And again, sometimes the anti-bullying initiatives don't address the disability issues, even though these other resources, they're just starting to learn about those, and that's important for them to know about.
And then on the other side of the coin, like when we had Anna Deragazi on and did the blog with regard to the recent state Supreme Court where the severe developmentally disabled woman was raped by her caretaker. I mean, the incidence of abuse among people with disabilities is extremely high, and that gets into a whole different area.
It's phenomenal. I just have to go on record as saying the Fortin case was just an abomination, in my opinion. It's so scary and so sad. I was at that oral argument, and I can't believe the case ended up the way it did. The other thing is that one of the things Governor's Prevention Partnership is moving into that I'm kind of dragging them into and is working in part with people with psychiatric disabilities, say, who go to social clubs who are bullied, or people in residential facilities. We've been working a lot with DDS as well as with DMIS, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services and Department on Developmental Disabilities, to look at bullying as it's kind of a precursor, like an antecedent behavior to abuse and neglect of people with disabilities. And our hope is that if they can stop some bullying behavior and nip it in the bud, maybe they can de-escalate some of the rampant abuse that happens. So that's an exciting initiative we're going to be involved in this winter and spring, and doing trainings with people who live in state of developmental disability services facilities.
Yeah, that really does make sense. With your background with regard to being the founding director of the Protection and Advocacy for Mentally Ill Persons program, What would be your commentary at this point with regard to the whole mental illness overlay with what happened at Sandy Hook? We've got about 13 minutes or so.
Okay. I also want to add, I was director of Advocacy Unlimited, and Advocacy Unlimited provides legal training to people with psychiatric disabilities in their rights, both in the community and in institutions. So I've had quite a bit of experience doing that.
Do you want to give some contact information with regard to any of these groups?
Advocacy Unlimited is 667-0460. And that's in Connecticut.
The area code 860?
860. They have a tremendous website. I don't have the URL for that, but if you Google Advocacy Unlimited, they have a wonderful website done by Norm Kidwell, who's their incredibly awesome webmaster. And they can get in touch with Advocacy Unlimited, and there's wonderful classes and initiatives they're doing. But let me talk a minute about Sandy Hook. And actually what I want to say about Sandy Hook is really brief, which will shock you. I have something brief to say. Mental illness does not correlate with one's ability to act violently. There isn't a correlation between mental illness and violence. The only linkage is that people with psychiatric disabilities and or mental illness, depending on how you want to frame it, is that they are more likely to be victims of violent acts. Okay? So that's the important thing I want everyone to come away with.
Say that again, that they're not – The two aren't linked, but they may there is a preponderance of those that they may be they may not exhibit violence, but be exposed to violence.
No, they're more likely to be victims of violence.
They are more likely to be victims.
If you have a psychiatric disability, you may be more likely to be a victim of violence. You are not more likely to commit an act of violence. Kind of case closed. That's kind of it.
Okay.
And. And some people are saying, but we need more services for mental health. We need more services for mental health, but not in terms of preventing, in terms of violence prevention. In my opinion, that's an issue about gun control. That's an issue about a whole bunch of other things. But just understand, the research bears out, people with disabilities are no more likely to be violent than people without psychiatric disabilities.
Okay.
So I just want everyone to get that and absorb that and kind of sit with that. And we
So where does this leave the insanity defense that so many defense attorneys like to bring up?
Well, it's funny you should bring that up. And I again could talk several hours on that, on this topic in the book I'm working on. I work a lot with people found not guilty by reason of insanity. And some people Some people commit acts of violence and plead not guilty by reason of insanity. It's a very bad idea, in my opinion, in Connecticut, because what happens is you can be held a lot longer than you would have normally. So you have situations sometimes where people have done nonviolent things or not very bad things, and they're serving 2 and 3 times their sentence in a forensic facility. So the not guilty, we tend to think of it as people getting off, in quotes, by not guilty by reason of insanity. But not guilty by reason of insanity is a very complex issue. It's a very complicated issue. And
hard to prove.
Well, it's hard to prove. It's hard to prove, but that's beside the point. All the people who do prove that, lots of them think it's not a good idea afterwards and end up serving more time than they would have had they not been adjudicated otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot to that.
There is.
There are some people, having said that, there are some people who have breaks and are legally insane, and that's not the people that are committing mass murders.
Mm-hmm. Well, Delilah, I think we should pair her with Doc Bond. It would be a good show.
I'm game. Let me know when.
We'll talk about that. Anyway, so what would you tell people whose mindset is that, oh, yes, this is all about mental illness, and they're the people that go crazy and have all these submachine guns and kill everybody? I mean, is there a standard response that you would say in terms of you're trying to say that it's apples and oranges?
Right. And it's human nature. We like to be able to protect things. And what happened in Sandy Hook obviously is horrible and tragic, and, you know, we can't even talk. There aren't words to say how terrible that is, you know. And I feel so much for all those people. And we like to understand as human beings why people do what they do so that we can predict that and maybe we can stop it from ever happening again. And I wish we could predict it, and I wish we could stop it from ever happening again. And I think that's why it's easy. It's kind of an easy out to say, oh, if that was somebody with a mental illness.
Yeah.
You know, or, you
don't
know, and people.
Don't you think a lot of times, too, in such tragic cases like Sandy Hook, it's so hard to wrap your mind around something this tragic. And as human beings, we reach out for something, we grab for something to blame, something to justify, something to explain, and
exactly.
Give us a little better
right,
understanding
of
what
yeah.
happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I know when Aurora happened in Colorado, you know, the press immediately said, well, this person obviously has schizophrenia. And a friend of mine who's a disability rights activist and her son has schizophrenia and was calling the press saying, wait, because the son's saying, wait, I don't want to go out. People are going to think, people know I have schizophrenia, they're going to think I'm going to shoot up a movie theater, and when I found out Aurora, my first thought was, you know, thank God he wasn't in the theater because he's the kind, you know, he might have gone to the movie at midnight kind of thing. And I think we need to be careful to confuse, to assign causality to something. And to get confused about something, and there are no simple answers, and that's a really hard thing to hear. If I could say it's because of X thing and we can fix it, it makes it more complicated.
Right.
And it also begs the question of issues like gun control and all those things as well.
Right.
But I think it's really important not to blame people and not to scapegoat people with psychiatric disabilities for things that happen.
It's
like
a broad brush on all people with mental illness or whatever. That's true. Because we're indicting them, and it is very individual. It's very complex. You know, the dynamics of the mother versus the son. There's a lot of dysfunction there. I mean, who knows? But what, since we have about 6 minutes or so, what is the charge that we need to take up currently with respect to people with mental illness in general? Is it the same as with disability? Do we need to have more time for the general public to understand, accept, and to know, or is it something else in particular?
It's understanding and awareness. And it's very interesting because when I was with Connecticut Business Leadership Network, they also have a great website, we did a career fair every year, and I'd have a conference attached to the career fair, and I'd have panels of people with disabilities who are successful in their jobs. And it was really great, and I try to get people with all kinds of disabilities. And the only position in the panels I had a hard time filling was people with psychiatric disabilities. Not because people with mental illness don't work, not because people with mental illness don't work in corporations, but because people with mental illness who work don't want to disclose that and are ashamed and are embarrassed and uncomfortable because they've experienced so much discrimination. there's mm-hmm. a word that that we use called stigma to describe, you know, what, how people with disabilities are treated, or the shame around having a psychiatric disability. And the commissioner of the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services recently said, and I wanted to stand up and share in my seat, she said, don't call it stigma. That kind of detracts from it. It's discrimination, and it's probably illegal. And people are afraid of being discriminated against. People are afraid of coming out. We made a video on the 20th anniversary of the ADA, and Karen Kengas, who directs Advocacy Unlimited now, said, you know, if everybody with a mental illness came out on midnight or noon on Saturday, then we wouldn't have the stigma issues, we wouldn't have the discrimination issues anymore. And I think she's really right.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of behind the shadows.
Right, it's behind the shadows, and I was once at a meeting where people were talking about, a business meeting, people talking about, oh, how those people with mental illness can come in and shoot up your corporation, and a person who was in the room came up to me afterwards, who was successfully employed and a successful business person, said, I was just diagnosed with bipolar, are they talking about me? And she wasn't going to say that. And I kind of stood up and kind of said, you know, people with psychiatric disabilities aren't more likely to be violent than anyone else, right? So it's the stigma and calling people on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's painful to call people on around Sandy Hook because everyone's so sad, as we should be, and it's so tragic, and it's a horrible situation.
Mm-hmm.
And people grasp at straws. People were even blaming that individuals with autism, that were on the autism spectrum, were more likely to commit
right.
violent crimes. And there's absolutely
right.
no evidence for that. And there isn't even the stereotypical anecdotal evidence for that. And that's, you know.
That is true. We just kind of look for excuses, and especially if they're not, if they're not out of, education, and they're just speculation, that's even more dangerous.
If someone with autism committed a crime, then it must have been the autism that caused it. Well, if someone with red hair committed a crime, you wouldn't probably blame the red hair on that. That was a characteristic, and you need to weigh that.
That's true. That's definitely
it's another arbitrary characteristic that may or may not contribute, and probably doesn't any more than the red hair does, yeah.
Right. Well, if you were in charge of the world, Melissa.
Yes, I like that.
3 minutes.
Oh boy.
I'd love you to be. what would you like to impart regarding disability issues in general, in terms of getting it? What can we do as a national audience to try to further the cause? Is there any way that we can help with the organizations that you've talked about, even if we're in another state? What's some practical advice? If people have a friend or relative with a disability, they generally treat them well because they know them, but it doesn't always translate to everybody else. God knows, we know that personally. What would you say?
Well, there's a dynamic where people kind of transfer things where suddenly I don't have a disability because I'm their friend Melissa, and then the next person with a disability they see as being special or different. Having people understand we're not special, we're not different, we're not better, we're not worse. We have lives, we may have wonderful lives, we may do wonderful things, kind of like everybody else. We're just the same. Sometimes they'll say in the workplace, oh, people with disabilities are better workers. And having fired more people with disabilities than most people will probably ever hire, I say, no, some are wonderful indeed, some are terrible indeed, and most are in the middle, kind of like everybody
right.
else. We're the same
right.
as everybody else.
You know, speaking about employment, at what point do you feel it's necessary to disclose a disability if you're applying for a job?
That's literally another show. An employer cannot ask you about your disability. That's prohibited under the Americans with Disabilities Act if they have more than 15
right.
employees. In most states, it's prohibited under state statute. I say disclose if you know you're going to need a reasonable accommodation, and not before then. Let them see what a wonderful person you are and then what a great work you are. Then disclose if you want to. Then it's fine to claim your disability and be proud of it.
Right.
And I just want to say, our lives are wonderful as people with disabilities, and I'm glad, Donna, in the introduction said our lives are not shattered. Our lives are just the same as everyone else's.
Our lives matter.
Our lives matter, absolutely.
Right. And our lives aren't any more sad.
You can see some of my issues, but you can't see other people's issues. You know, someone else can be struggling with poverty or other kinds of things or bad things in their life or being abused, and you can see my scooter when I'm using it. And that's the only difference, is you can see my issues and not someone else's.
Right, and it's a part of our life, but it doesn't make up our entire life. And
exactly.
We deal with what we have, we find a way, we're productive, we're motivated. You and I are. You know
yep.
we are. And
most
that,
did.
That, what? That's the way people should think about it. And everyone should be as accepting as people like Delilah. If we had more, you know, 100,000 people like Delilah, I would be, like, so very happy. Because, you know, she makes everyone at face value. Huh?
I said that's only because even with your disability, you can still walk faster than I can.
Well, thank you, my dear.
Longer.
I try. But with that, I have to say our show is fast coming to an end. Melissa, let's talk off there. We're going to have to do another show on some other topics. I think it's kind of dead. You know, it's been so pleasurable, so informational. I thank you so much. Please do keep in touch with me. So we're going to say goodnight for now, and please do look within the next 24 hours. We'll have the blog and the podcast up, and you'll be able to listen and read about it forever. And we'll be back in touch with maybe a follow-up show in the spring. So thank you again, Melissa.
Thank you very much, Delilah. Thank you, Dawn and Delilah.
It was great. Great show.
Yes, thank you, and I we'll talk soon, okay?
Thank you so much.
Good night, everyone. Have a nice weekend, and we'll see you next Saturday.